Hello, I'm Alison Larkin, writer, comedian, narrator, and host of the Jane Austen podcast. Join me as we embark on a journey through Austen's timeless stories, starting with Pride and Prejudice. The Jane Austen podcast with Alison Larkin is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist.
This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspectives.
Hi, and welcome back for part two. We've never done that before. I feel
We've
like we had to have a real serious intro.
Hello. You know? And welcome back to part two of the War on Terror for Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist.
Is that your NPR voice? Because
yes,
it kind of sounds scary.
Every once in a while, I turn on my NPR voice for you all. We're here to talk about the War on Terror.
You were also making very intense eye contact, which was very nerve-wracking for me personally.
Hi.
Very uncomfortable right now.
We always get a little silly after doing the mini. Okay, yes, this is our first ever two-parter. We just spent like 3 minutes before pressing record. Like, where the fuck were we? Where did we leave
Where
off?
Are we going?
Like, I feel like, so you all know, if you've listened, you know I love the show True Crime Obsessed. And when they do their two-parters, I think they do it in one day. And they keep going.
Mm-hmm. I think most people do that. It's been a week for us.
It's been a week. So I was like, what did we talk about last week? Where are we going? So luckily, Keegan and I were able to put our noggins together and figure it out. So we repeat a few things. We apologize. It is not as fresh in our minds as we would like it to be with the part one, but whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
We do what we want.
I think we kind of left off in the days after 9/11, whenever Bush had made it very clear that we were going to war.
Right.
The AUMF had passed at this time, which basically gave him blanket authority to start the War on Terror.
Do what he wanted to do.
Yeah. And there was only one dissenting voice. Our lovely Miss Barbara Lee was the only dissenting voice who didn't think that maybe this was the best idea.
Barbara Lee, DM us.
I mean, listen, we have your back. Although I do feel like she's made statements recently talking about how she does feel vindicated. I mean, there's no joy in right. But
vindication, I think, isn't necessarily stating joy. It's just saying, like, I told you so.
Yeah, I mean, this could have been avoided if you just listened to
Usually
me.
When you say I told you so, something good didn't happen.
Right.
So,
exactly.
You know?
So, we kind of left off after 9/11, so we wanted to start this episode talking about kind of the things that changed in the states after 9/11, because I feel like we mentioned this on the last episode. There's a whole generation now of people who didn't grow up in a time before.
Yes.
Right? So they don't know a time when you didn't have to take off your shoes to go to the airport.
Well, that's actually the first thing that I want to talk about, because I think that then we'll get into more of, you know, the political changes and things like that. But let's talk a little bit about airport security changes. So prior to September 11th, 2001, airport screening was provided by private security companies contracted by the airline or airport. It wasn't a TSA, like a national kind of thing. It was just each airport or airline had its own way of doing things. The TSA, which is the Transportation Security Administration, was introduced to take over all the security functions. And with that, they put in bulletproof and locked cockpit doors, which became standard on commercial passenger planes. Because as we remember, what was it? Is it Flight 178? Was it? I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head. That the one that crashed in Pennsylvania because the passengers were able to...
I feel like that was United 93. I only remember that because there was a movie called United 93.
Okay, yeah, you're right. So, because they were able to, you know, kind of try to infiltrate, the hijackers were able to take over the planes, so they wanted to make sure that the cockpits were more heavily secured. I can't say cockpit without wanting to laugh.
Madigan, you're 29.
Cockpit. I'm sorry. Cockpit is funny. It's a funny thing to say. Some planes are also equipped with CCTV cameras so the pilots can monitor passenger activity. And pilots are now allowed to carry firearms, but they must be trained and licensed. And then also air marshals became more of a common thing. If any of you have seen Bridesmaids, Melissa McCarthy's character is sitting next to her real life husband, and she's like convinced that he's an air marshal, and he's like, no, I'm not. And this whole thing. that became much more common on just regular passenger flights to have an air marshal there. And it really is weird to think about, you know, when I was a kid up until I was 9, I would have people who dropped me off at the airport. Like, I mean, obviously with my family, they could walk me all the way to my gate.
Oh, yeah.
And,
I mean,
and wave at me from the plane.
Wave from the window. That was very, very common. And especially since, I mean, my mom put me and my brother on planes alone when we were like 7 and 8.
Yeah.
You know, and so to do that, to feel comfortable as a parent, they let the parent walk right through security with you and walk you all the way up and put you on the plane themselves.
Which I think now there are still ways to do that, but I know there's also like babysitters that you can like pay to have like take your
kids. Hand your kid off to a stewardess or something like that.
It is really funny to watch, like we're both big Friends fans, so I always remember the episode where Chandler says he's going to Yemen and Janice like follows him all the way to the gate and he's like, I guess I'm going to Yemen.
Chandler could have gotten away nowadays.
Yeah, nowadays, you know, he would have like,
dipped out after security.
He could have just like pretended to be in the security line for like 2 seconds and then dipped out and Janice would have been none the wiser.
Yeah, same thing with the episode where Emily sees them, sees Ross and Rachel get on the plane going to Greece.
Never would have happened.
So many issues could have been avoided.
Yep.
So many Friends related scenarios could have been avoided.
But it really is a weird thing to think about because there are so many things that we go through. You know, you got to take your shoes off and your belts and you're this and you're that. And then also the full body scanners were not a thing. Yeah. Do you remember the controversy over that when it first became a thing?
Yes.
There's a big thing about it being too invasive and like, you know, they're seeing your naked body.
Nobody thinks about it.
Nobody thinks twice, but it was a huge, huge deal. It was like a huge invasion of privacy and all of this kind of stuff where now everybody knows to, you know, put your arms up and your legs spread and let the thing go.
Right. I mean, if you're on a plane enough, which I have been kind of lately, like, you know, the whole drill, it's like the hair goes up, the shoes are off before I'm even like up there.
Yeah.
My two laptops are out and they're in individual containers, you know?
Yeah.
But the reasons why they decided to make a lot of these changes and the reasons why there's also like no fly lists and things like that, they're far more strict about who comes in and out of the country.
Yeah.
In part, it's because in the year before 9/11, there was a miscommunication or a lack of communication between the CIA and the FBI, and it failed to alert them that people who they knew were closely tied to Al-Qaeda had come into the country, right? So the CIA knew that these people had come into the country,
right?
But they like missed the handoff to give that information to the FBI.
Right.
So in the days after 9/11, people were like, how could these people have been living here our noses?
And they set off the metal detectors. That's the thing. Like, there were metal detectors still in airports. And I guess it says that on the morning of 9/11, the hijackers all set off metal detectors, but were still able to pass through. And so because of that, security personnel is now more thoroughly trained to detect weapons and explosives. That's when all the sizes changed for what you could bring. You know, you could only bring a little bit of shampoo and a little bit of that because
you can have liquid explosives.
It
is my understanding, and I could be wrong about this, that they set off the metal detectors, but when they were searched, the hijackers had brought with them short-bladed knives.
Yes.
Which at the time were allowed on planes.
Yes, exactly.
Like, it wasn't like... Nowadays, I was in San Francisco, coming back from San Francisco to Los Angeles, and I had one of those, like, little pocket knives.
Yeah.
That, like, had that, like, tiny, like... I don't know, like itty bitty.
Was it like
file.
One of those that also has like a nail clipper and a
and like
and
a screw, like a teeny tiny corkscrew.
Yeah, one of those like all encompassing little things you can stick in your pocket.
That tiny corkscrew could not open a bottle of wine though. Like, let's be real, I don't understand why that's in there.
Yeah, quick fact: my dad never wore a pair of pants that didn't have one of those in the pocket. He had one of those little, what are they called? The little pocket knives.
They're like Swiss Army knives, but they're tiny, tiny ones.
But that also has the file and the this or whatever. Like, my dad never went anywhere without one of those in his pants pocket. So if you ever needed anything, my dad was like, shh,
and
ready.
Like, the one I had in San Francisco couldn't have done anything. Like, it literally, that little file, you could have broken it in half if you wanted. It was one of those novelty ones that was probably given to me at like some event, you know?
Right.
But it was confiscated, right? And that thing couldn't have done any damage. But these hijackers, specifically the ones who were on the plane that hit the Pentagon, they had these short-bladed knives on them and they were allowed on planes. It wasn't something that people were concerned about because we didn't think of it in terms of political motives. Like,
no,
we were just like, stuff happens on planes, people act out, but we always thought about it as kind of like one-off instances. We didn't think about it as an organized event that could happen.
Yeah, you know? Like hijackings are not uncommon. If any of you are interested, go watch the DB Cooper documentary on HBO. Holy shit. It's so
there was a period of time where hijacks were pretty commonplace, like in the 70s.
But it's really funny.
No one got hurt either.
In that documentary, they say it's like it was usually just like Cuban internationals that wanted to go home. You get a bottle of rum, some cigars, and you just have like essentially an extra layover.
Right.
And everyone got home fine.
Weren't scared. Yeah. You know, in the 70s, you know, by the time.
I mean, then you could smoke on planes and stewardesses were treated horribly. It was a whole thing.
So they put all these things in place essentially to try and prevent people from being able to enter the country or hijack planes. But if they were able to capture somebody they suspected of having information, they also wanted to figure out like how best to gather the information in order to find these people and then how best to question them.
Right.
And so a lot of things happened after 9/11 in addition to like security that was put into place. In addition to military efforts, there was also an increased effort domestically to prevent future attacks.
Yeah.
And so that kind of led us into the Patriot Act. There was a lot of talk about the Patriot Act whenever I was a kid.
Yeah.
This was a hotly debated topic even then. Again, my family was so pro do whatever you got to do to protect America.
Right.
That I feel like it wasn't something that was controversial in my house. But upon kind of taking a closer look at it as an adult, it's a very scary thing. So
yeah.
It was passed 45 days after the September 11th attacks, and it was passed in the name of national security.
Yeah.
So the Patriot Act was the first of many changes to surveillance laws that made it easier for the government to spy on regular, ordinary Americans by expanding the authority to monitor phone and email communications, collect bank and credit card report records, and track the activity of innocent Americans. So Americans that you have no real evidence that you might have a suspicion. Somebody may have called in and said, you see something, say something, right? Someone might have called in and said, hey, I suspect Madigan of this thing. And the government would have the right then to look at your credit card statements, look at your phone calls, read your emails.
Yeah.
They could go so far as to go into your house, what was called the sneak and peek warrants, which was basically that allowed the government to go into your home and leave without informing you that they were there.
Oh my gosh.
They could go into your home. They could take whatever they wanted. They didn't have to inform you that they were there, and there would be no paper trail of the fact that this is something that happened.
Okay. That to me, everything else is like sketchy. Yes. I kind of understand it in a way, but then at the same time,
I don't trust the government at all, though.
Well, but like, that's the thing is, like, I think that's coming from privilege on my part, because I think that for Muslim Americans or anybody that has maybe a little bit of a different name or multiple countries on their passports, that's when that invasion of privacy is going to be scary. Because to me, I'm like, okay, well, I'm not really worried about what the government is going to find and say about me. But like I said, I think that's coming from like a very, very privileged perspective. But at the same time, it's like I am for surveillance in so many ways for so many reasons, which is why it's kind of a complicated thing in my head.
See, for me, knowing about COINTELPRO, knowing about what the FBI has done, what the FBI did to the Black Panthers, what the FBI did to Martin Luther King Jr., I don't trust them with this level of it just kind of being a free-for-all and allowing you to do whatever you want.
Totally.
It's very scary because it's a very slippery slope in terms of what they will use it for.
Right.
Like, if they were using it strictly for this one thing, then it's like, eh, maybe. Because, again,
but it's
for
like,
myself
what if they
personally,
find something else or, you know.
And, again, like, and we're going to get into this, but absolutely, it was so easy to profile people. And we're in a post-11 a post 9/11 world,
yeah,
where the country is extremely paranoid and right. Islamophobic.
Well, but that's what I'm saying. It's like I realize the fact that like the reason I think that is because I am a white woman. Like I'm my chances of being profiled for someone but in the government is very, very slim. You know what right. I mean? And so for me, it's like that's how I've always felt. But I really do think that it's because I haven't had to live with that fear of right. being profiled.
There has to be strict protections in place.
100%.
To yeah. avoid some of this, because there were even people who were working in national security at the time who were like, you can't do this. Like, this is an insane overreach, because things got really fast and loose really quickly. Like, we yeah. were living in a digital age, and it was hard to parse through what information warranted being taken and from whom. So the government basically made deals with tech companies like AT&T and Verizon, and they Shitty. Just took all of the information. They yeah. just took it all. And they were like, take it all from everybody and we'll figure it out later.
Because see, that's the thing. Like, if there's an investigation, you think about, you know, getting warrants for phone records and all this kind of stuff. And I feel like the reason that we have all of that is to protect citizens. Like, you have to get a warrant to search somebody's home. A police officer can't just come in. You
right.
know,
it was a violation of our Fourth Amendment rights. Like right. there are rights there that are rights to privacy.
There has to be steps taken mm-hmm. before you immediately take information
and
on
you
someone
have
else.
To be able to have a reasonable suspicion. Yes. And a reasonable suspicion like, goes beyond evidence. A feeling, right? Like you right. can't just be like, this person gives me bad vibes.
But that's like what a warrant is. Like, you have to go to a judge and
exactly.
you have to say, we're looking for these specific things for this specific reason. And it has to be very, very specific, signed off by a judge. Then you can go and search the house or the car.
And we know that those things
whatever.
Get abused all the time as well. So
true.
Like, this being this like just
open-ended.
Completely open-ended.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's still in effect. Like, the Patriot Act is technically still in effect, even
it's
though
it's probably what all of our terms of agreement say is like, all of this information will be sent to the US government.
I mean, it's really insane, because President Bush, or former President George W. Bush, he gave a speech in 2005 where he said that the Patriot Act had been used to bring charges against more than 400 suspects, more than half of whom had been convicted. Meanwhile, the ACLU quoted the Justice Department figure showing that 7,000 people had complained of abuse of the act. So there had been like 400 suspects, half of whom, so 200 people, had been convicted of something. What?
Yeah.
We don't know. And also, we don't know if he's telling the truth, because the Bush administration had a habit of lying.
Yeah.
But the ACLU is saying, hey, there have been 7,000 complaints of overreach.
Yeah.
Due to this act. Right.
Right.
So it's just
let's,
do
something about it.
Do the ends justify the means?
No.
You know what I mean? Like, and again, the majority of the people who were victimized by this were Muslim Americans.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about Islamophobia in the United States post 9/11.
So I copy pasted this quote. I don't remember from where, because I didn't cite it underneath. Silly me. But it says, in orchestrating the attacks on September 11th, 2001, Osama bin Laden had wanted to end the global reign of a decadent West, inflict a staggering blow to the American democracy, and entangle every Muslim in the conflict. Bin Laden may be dead, but it is hard not to conclude that he got what he wanted. And I think that is really poignant, because I think that Osama bin Laden had this goal of exposing the West for all of its ways that it's bad and damaging, and kind of pitting this war between the West and Al-Qaeda, Muslim people, and all of these other things that he saw as making them othered. And I think that that's where he really succeeded in
right. I mean, I
kind of bringing out the worst in the U.S. in that sense.
It was something that was always there. It's the same kind of thing when we did our model minority episode, where it's proximity to whiteness and a seemingly acceptance of you by the dominant Anglo culture
right.
does not necessarily mean you are one of them. And all
yeah.
it takes is one event, or, you know, in this case, in the case that we were talking about for that episode, it was COVID, right?
Yeah.
It just takes one precipitating event for the dominant culture to highlight to you that you are not like them,
yeah.
that you are other from them, and they can take that back at any time. Your yeah. Americanness, they can withdraw that at any time.
But they still want to, you know, use all the wonderful things that you've brought into right, the country right. and all this other stuff.
It doesn't matter that, like, you were born in the United States.
Right.
It doesn't matter if you were from the country, right? It didn't matter. It wasn't just people from Afghanistan who were being persecuted, which would be fucked up anyway.
Well, and I mean,
it was any Muslim person, and beyond that, it was anybody who looked like they could be. It
right.
was Sikhs was were being persecuted.
So many, I'm sorry if I'm not saying this correctly, but Sikh people were being
yes.
very, very heavily
yeah, yeah,
attacked at this time, even though they had nothing to do with the Muslim religion. You know what I mean? Like, but it was this idea of anybody, you know, wearing a turban or a hijab or anything like that was suddenly looked at sideways and questioned because...
Well, and straight up called a terrorist. Like, yes. that was something that was happening all of the time.
Well, I mean, and it's still so frustrating to this day. So my friend Sean that I had in college that mm-hmm. you know, he is from Sri Lanka, and like pretty much all of the roles that he's gotten post-college or what he's been stereotyped as is a terrorist. And I have multiple friends who are of the Middle Eastern descent who, you know, do extra work and things like that. And they're always... the terrorist.
Oh,
and
yeah.
it's so upsetting. Yeah. Actually, one of my friends was on that show. What was the Hulu show? Oh, I can't remember what it was called, but he was, he's from the Middle East. He's from Syria, I believe. And it was like a really big Hulu show, and it was his first like big role ever. And he played a terrorist, but he was like, this is the one time I'm like cool with it because he was like a main role. You know what I mean?
No, but that's fucked
still,
up.
Like, it's still totally fucked up.
Like, again, we need to stay on task. Yes. So I don't want to like go off
on a
tangent.
We won't go into casting and all that kind of stuff. But what I'm saying is that there's this generalization of it, you know?
It is that part of United States culture, especially as somebody who is a non-white actor, is so fucked up. And so detrimental, and yeah. something that we really need to take a close look at.
Yeah. We've been having like casting like issues on our list for a really long time of episodes to, you know, episode discussions to talk about, but it goes to show, I mean, when you look at the way that things are cast, it kind of shows how America thinks of certain groups of people. So I think that, you know, my friend Sean is not Muslim. He is a Catholic kid from Sri Lanka, yet he is going to be typecast as a terrorist for performance use and probably in real life as well. And
well,
that's the
yeah.
thing where it kind of imitates
it happened for
life.
Me and my brother as well, because we are biracial. We're half black and we're half white. But because of our features, like we both have kind of like straight, long noses.
Yeah.
We have brown skin. My brother grew curly hair, curly beard. Those kinds of things
that might
people
be
didn't know
typically profiled as
right. So people yeah. didn't know. So they would give you double takes, right? Like, and we saw it because we were living in a majority white place.
That makes me so mad.
But it was, and if it was like that for us, imagine what it was like for people who were actually practicing Muslims, oh. especially in New York City.
Yeah.
For instance, there was a large controversy that happened. There was a Muslim man who had come over here to the United States in hopes of kind of showing people like, this
hey.
Is the beauty of the Islamic faith,
yeah.
right? And kind of wanting to bring people together. And he wanted to create this, what he called the Islamic YMCA, so like a community Aww. Center specifically for Muslim youth.
Yeah.
A reminder that the YMCA is actually a Christian organization, whether you remember that or not. And he wanted to create something similar. It was kind of close in proximity to Ground Zero.
Okay.
It was a few blocks away.
Yeah.
People lost their fucking minds. And the ugliest stuff came out of people saying you're letting the terrorists win by allowing this mosque to be built near Ground Zero. You know, just the most vile, the most Islamophobic
and uneducated,
bigoted things.
Yeah.
And it was all over Fox News. Fox yeah. News got a hold of it to the point that he had to drop the project.
Yeah.
And when you watch, he speaks on the Turning Point documentary on Netflix. And when you watch him talking about this, you can see that it is something that has truly affected him and has kind of broken his heart. And
well,
I cannot
he was
imagine
trying to do something that was going to help his community, but also to help America kind of see another side of Islamic people. And, you know, I think about even, you know, Malcolm X and things like that, who were part of that religion that have always been seen as like hyper radicalized. And I think that, you know, having a place like a YMCA was such a great idea to be able to kind of like educate, normalize, have a sense of community.
A place where all people were welcome together.
Exactly. Because, yeah. And it's such a harmless idea that it's so upsetting to me that he wasn't able to follow through with that.
And beyond just him, who you could see on a personal level, it was very difficult and painful for him.
Right.
The number of people, I think about young people, I think about people who are my age, who yeah. maybe at that time
grew up
that way. In their early teens, right? Constantly seeing, you turn on the TV and you have these people saying Muslims are terrorists and we can't have a mosque being built anywhere near
Ground Zero.
It's disrespectful to the people that died. You know, what does that say about you?
Yeah.
What does that make you think about yourself?
Mm,
right?
Yeah.
And like, what kind of abuse are you and your family suffering? What have you suffered?
Yeah.
Because of something that had nothing to do with you.
Right. And the numbers really are astronomical. So in 2000, the year before the attacks, there were 28 recorded hate crimes against Muslim people. In 2001, that number reached 481.
That were reported.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there were above 28 in 2000 as well, but I mean, 28 to 481 reported cases.
Yeah.
In a year?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, I can't imagine it.
I can't imagine being like, I know how like traumatized I was by that situation. I can't imagine how Muslim children felt during that time in the US.
The only thing I can think of is the absolute fear and grief that I felt last summer.
Yeah.
And that I have felt many times over in the wake of police violence and brutality against Black Americans, or the way that I feel whenever I look back on certain instances in the civil rights movement, and the way that that makes me feel, knowing that these are people who look like me, who are like me. I can't. And I say all of that, and I still say I cannot imagine this specific situation, because right. it was such a grand scale, and it felt like everybody in the world, you know, like last episode we talked about how people who didn't live through it can't fathom the unity that happened during that time. That's true, except for if you were a Muslim American. And so you're witnessing this profound, powerful
hate.
Unity.
Yeah.
And being on the outside of it.
Yeah.
And being on the outside of it was hate. Like, it was hate. It was us versus them. And they're seeing the entire fucking country come together. And what it would feel like to me is against you.
Yeah.
You know, and also having those conflicting feelings of being an American and having that grief that we felt, right? Like,
right.
That
and your they want to be able to feel that too,
right. you
but they're
feel.
Not allowed to because of their religion or the way they look or the way they're treated by other people.
Because you feel like you're being pushed on, the conflicting feelings of being an American and wanting to process what just happened.
Yeah.
And also feeling like the world is saying this is your fault.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
It really, I mean, being an adult now and thinking back on it, the way that we attacked a religious group as a whole makes absolutely no sense to me.
And just people who looked a certain way as well, you know.
But I mean, to specifically say that like Muslim people are people that we should be feared, it's just the most uneducated response. It's a lack of knowledge of the religion. It's a lack of knowledge about whether or not they are radicalized or not. Al-Qaeda is not the Muslim religion. And I feel like a lot of what I was told as a child, even though I had wonderful parents who steered me in another direction, I feel like a lot of what was being inundated upon me was that anybody who looked that way is someone to be feared. And it wasn't because of the knowledge of what the religion really was, which is incredibly peaceful, but it was skewed in a way of that the religion is violent. And that was what the media was portraying, is that if you are Muslim, you are being taught violent ideologies. Mm-hmm. And that was is what was so damaging, I think, to that whole generation coming up and hearing these things and taking it as fact and truth.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it was kind of a high and mighty stance for us to have when, let's go into our next talking point here.
Yes.
So not long after the 9/11 attacks, we started offering large bounties to anyone who would turn in people who were suspected of being involved with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban in any way, if they were adjacent in any way to what happened on 9/11 or connected in any way.
Yeah.
So we started dropping leaflets from airplanes over Afghanistan saying that people would be rewarded not only with cash, but also with food and other incentives. So we were saying, we were dropping these leaflets that were saying, you start turning people in, we will give you enough food, enough money to take care of your entire village, right? So of course, this led to a ton of profiling and people being captured or imprisoned who never should have been.
Right.
So there were a lot of people in the surrounding areas, the surrounding countries who were turning in people in Afghanistan. And these were students, reporters, hundreds of people. You may have gotten some who were also involved with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
But there was not really any way to know because it was just hundreds of people, right?
Yeah, it's just citizens calling in and telling you what
and we
they
were
think
like,
they know.
Cool, we're going to take them all. And we had more people than we knew what to do with. And we needed to figure out what to do with these people because we didn't want to release them if any of them could be terrorists. And until we figured that out, we were like, okay, what do we do? So politically, the Bush administration didn't think that it was a good look to build a giant prison in Afghanistan. They were like, okay, we want to remain on good terms with the Afghan people. So we don't want to build a giant prison there to hold these people. It also wasn't a good look with
to have
everything,
it in the U.S.
Right, with everything we just said about the way that Americans were feeling specifically towards Muslim people or Middle Eastern people to relocate them to some of our kind of max security prisons here in the United States. So because of that, you know, we settled on Cuba.
Yeah.
So the U.S. government set up Guantanamo Bay detention camp in 2002. And this was a quote from that documentary. They said the State Department were told to look for the legal equivalent of outer space. And that's what Guantanamo Bay was meant to be, a place where no law applied.
Ooh.
Right.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. and you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales, because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
So the detainees were brought over mostly from Afghanistan. And when you look at these pictures, first of all, don't. But if you do, any of these pictures, if you search Guantanamo Bay, it is some of the most upsetting stuff you're going to see.
Yeah.
So there are pictures of the way that they were transported on these planes. They are transported strapped to each other. So they are strapped down to each other, upright, with a lot of sensory deprivation items on. So like hoods, goggles, they can't see.
Why?
So they're coming over because we were told, and you can watch the footage, like we were told these were the worst of the worst.
Right.
These were absolutely terrorists. These were absolutely people who wanted to murder Americans, right? So we had to take the utmost precautions with these people.
What, so they didn't know where they were going? Like, that seems to be a bit, they're on a fucking plane. Like, what? But I don't know.
We treated them like cargo. Like, that's really what it looks like. Like, they look like they're being treated like cargo. And then there is video footage of them being led out of the plane and into the facility. Again, shackled to each other,
right,
wearing hoods. And meanwhile, the U.S. military, again, is doing its best to convince us that these people are here to kill us. So our hearts were hardened.
It kind of reminds me of like the internment camps a little bit. And that's what I was going to say that I forgot, where it's like, I wonder if the reason why they didn't want it on U.S. soil was so maybe that it wouldn't have the same connotation as the internment camps in World War II.
I think it was because they wanted to be able to do what they wanted with these prisoners.
But without it being, because I feel like there is something about it being on American soil where it is.
There's oversight. They didn't want oversight.
Yeah. But it is like, it's more obviously like your fault when it's on American soil. You know what I mean? So I feel like there's almost this like detachment that they have by sending these people to Cuba instead of having it be actually on, you know, the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was just less, it was less easy to monitor what was happening there.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly. Americans wouldn't have to be like aware of it all the time if it's in another country. We don't think about it.
Right. No, we don't. I mean, and we saw the footage and we saw the pictures, but again,
we were told that they were terrorists and the worst of the worst.
And like I said in our last episode, it should upset you that our grief and our fear, and in the aftermath of this horrible trauma that happened to all of us, was exploited immediately. And this is part of that. Like, we were, we saw the pictures of these people being held in pens like animals. It looked like kennels.
But if
at
you're
the same
told
time,
that they are the worst of the worst,
and that's what we're hearing constantly,
then that's what you would want to, if somebody truly is the worst of the worst, then maybe that would seem like justice. You know what I mean? So that's why people weren't automatically outraged, because at the time we were buying into so much of what was being told to us because all of us were at such a vulnerable
state. I would hope that we eventually get to a place as a culture and as a society where we have enough empathy where, even if it is the worst of the worst, you shouldn't look at that and feel nothing. Like, you just shouldn't.
Honestly, yeah. I mean, that's why I'm very anti-death penalty. Like, there's a lot of, you know, things with that where I feel like even if a person has done horrible things, they are still human.
Your level of empathy should be higher than that. That's just how I feel.
Yeah, I agree.
So because we were fighting this abstract idea, which was terrorism and not a nation that wore a uniform.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I don't mean to cut you off here, but that's like one of the criticisms with calling it the war on terror in total. There is this guy who is a linguist. His name is George Lakoff, who argues that there literally cannot be a war on terror since terror is an abstract noun. He says terror cannot be destroyed by weapons or signing a peace treaty. A war on terror has no end.
It has no end and allows you to do horrific things because, as we see here, because we were not fighting a nation with a uniform, the Bush administration made the decision that the Geneva Convention did not apply to the detainees, who they refused to call prisoners because they didn't want them to be looked at as prisoners of war.
Right.
So they had no rights under international law because we weren't fighting a country. We were fighting an idea.
Yeah.
And so there was a loophole there where we didn't have to treat them the way that we would normally have to. We didn't have to offer up the same human rights that we would have to offer up any other prisoner of war.
Right.
Right.
Oh,
they
God,
didn't have access to lawyers. They didn't have access of any kind of due process at all.
That is such bullshit.
It's absolute bullshit. And
can you imagine being on that plane with a hood and shackled, brought to a place, be like, sorry, you don't get a lawyer, you don't get that. I mean, that's basically what our borders are like right now, but it just, to think about being in their shoes causes me so much anxiety.
And just most of these people, and that's what they were saying, a lot of these people who were at these detention camps, they were mentally prepared for rabid dogs because of the way that it had been framed to them. And what they said was, these people are sheep farmers, right? Like the majority of the people here are normal people, right? And they're being held in these conditions. And these inmates were tortured. And it was encouraged by the Bush administration to torture them.
Yeah.
And they didn't call it torture. They called it enhanced interrogation techniques.
Yes. Yep.
So some of these techniques included forced 24-hour nudity, 24-hour a day light, 24-hour a day cold, 24-hour a day darkness, waterboarding. And it's some of the most disgusting stuff I've ever seen in the pictures that you will see.
Yeah.
But then you have the banality of evil on the other side of it, where you are hearing and watching Bush administration officials now talk about this and underplay how bad it was.
Yeah.
Which is also really gross. Like, I was watching Bush admin members try and justify what they were doing by saying things like, but you could only waterboard them in this very particular way. You could only hit them in this very specific way.
I'm sorry.
And hey, we never shoved needles up their fingernails or into their eyeballs, so it was fine. It wasn't that bad. Right?
Okay. Let's be done with corporal punishment, torture, all of those things. I get it. You want to get information out of these
people.
But it
doesn't work.
No. Can we like bring some psychologists in here and figure out how to work with these like possibly maybe psychopathic people? What is the best way to get information out of them? Like, why do we?
The CIA inspector general in 2004 came to the conclusion that they were unable to prove that a single imminent threat was disrupted because of the enhanced interrogation techniques.
Mm-hmm.
John McCain, who was a prisoner of war vet himself, would go on to say that these techniques provided very little useful intelligence to help track down anyone involved in 9/11 or to prevent new attacks.
Yep.
In fact, he felt that torturing the detainees only provoked our enemies and could potentially have consequences in the future, which,
right, because they're like, you're hurting more of our people. We're going to be even more mad at you and fight back even that much more heavily.
Right. And he also made a good point in terms of like, hey, we still have our guys over there. Like, what happens? He was a prisoner of war, right? What happens if a member of the Taliban gets one of our guys?
Yeah.
What happens if they're prisoners?
Eye for an eye.
Right? Like, it's so counterintuitive, and we didn't even get any real information. Like, that's kind of the thing, is like, we got little things here and there that they said came out of this.
It makes me so mad.
Right. But still, the Bush administration stood by their decision. They said that it was the right move at the time. Since inmates were detained indefinitely without trial and several detainees were tortured, this camp is considered to be a major breach of human rights by Amnesty International.
Well, fuck yeah.
So most prisoners of Guantanamo Bay were eventually freed without ever being charged with any crime and were transferred to other countries. Today, though, 40 men remain in prison and almost three quarters of them have never been criminally charged. They're known as, quote, forever prisoners and are being held indefinitely.
Are you fucking kidding me?
No, they're still people.
Can we
still
go
have people there,
there now and break them out? Because what the fuck?
Well, look at, I mean, and that's the thing.
20 years, Keegan. Yeah. 20 years. And, they have not been charged.
We had a whole ass 2 terms of President Barack Obama in that time period. Why are they still there?
Oh, why are they still there? Oh my God, that is so upsetting.
Yeah, it's incredibly upsetting. You know what else is upsetting?
Let's break them out. Let's break them
you
out.
You and I, let's break them out of Guantanamo Bay.
We got this, girl. You know, we got this.
Another thing that is deeply upsetting, because I just feel like the hits are going to keep coming right through the end of this episode, okay? This is not fun times through
no,
the end
it's
of this
not.
Episode.
This is not laughs. Fun laughs, good times.
When people think about the war on terror, they think about the war in Afghanistan, but they also think about the war in Iraq. So,
which I just got to say was so confusing to me as a child when Afghanistan seemed to be our primary target. And then all of a sudden we were in another country.
Same.
In my head as a child, I was like, oh, well, Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden were friends. They were in on it together because I was a kid. Well, I didn't fucking know. You
it's
know
not
what I mean?
Your fault. They straight up said that.
Yeah.
They straight up said that.
Yeah.
So pretty much right away, the Bush administration was trying to use the AUMF, which is the Authorization for Use of Military Force Against Terrorists Act, as an excuse to go after Saddam Hussein, despite the fact that he had nothing to do with 9/11.
No, he had nothing to do with 9/11, but Iraq itself had been listed as a state sponsor of terrorism by the U.S. since 1990 when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. So I think it was more of like an opportunistic thing because it's a war on terror. It's not a war on Afghanistan or anything like that. This was their moment to be able to go after Saddam Hussein for what he did to Kuwait in 1990.
Right. They definitely wanted to go after him because of that. And also the reason why we went into Saudi Arabia after he went into Kuwait, after Saddam went into Kuwait, was to protect our oil interests.
Yes.
So there was absolutely that motivation here as well.
It was for fucking money.
Yeah, we wanted to protect our oil interests. So President Bush spoke with on the day of the attacks, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld asked his aides for, quote, best info fast, judge whether good enough hit Saddam Hussein at the same time. So it was like a short message, right? He was basically saying like, hey, we need to figure out a motivation to get us into Iraq.
Yeah.
With all the chaos that was going on in 9/11,
like,
he was
hey, we got to get in there.
I see an opening for us to get into Iraq. How can we spin this in order to get us in there? Like,
oh my God.
Immediately from word go, right?
Yeah.
So months later, they decided they were going to visit Bush at his ranch in Texas to discuss moving into Iraq. So President Bush spoke with Rumsfeld on the 21st of November and instructed him to conduct a confidential review of a war plan to invade Iraq. So Rumsfeld met with the general, Tommy Franks, and they were trying to figure out, they're basically like, okay, let's brainstorm how to start possible justifications for entering into a war with Iraq.
Right.
So they made this connection between Saddam Hussein and Al Qaeda, which didn't exist.
Yeah.
Like there wasn't one.
Yeah.
They kind of just decided that there was one. And in fact, the executive assistant director of the FBI, Dale Watson, told the Bush administration that there was no relationship between Al Qaeda and Iraq.
Right.
But Bush announced to the American people that there was. Like, you can watch his State of the Union where he says that. So he began formally making his case to the international community for the invasion of Iraq on September 12th, 2002. So a year after the September 11th attack.
Yep.
Colin Powell gave a speech indicating that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and that there were connections between bin Laden and Hussein. The only information that they had to corroborate this story was a tortured Guantanamo Bay detainee who later admitted to lying under torture.
Oh, my God. Okay. I didn't even mention this earlier, but if you look at like false confessions in the US and just like bad police interrogations where it's like they're without food and water and break for 13 hours, they're being interrogated and threatened and all this stuff. Of course, you're going to give any information that you think this person could possibly want to make you stop being fucking tortured.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is when we kind of start to see a split between the United States and NATO, because everybody was kind of on our side up until this point. But the British government found no evidence that Iraq possessed nuclear weapons or any other weapons of mass destruction. And France didn't either. They were like, this seems weird. Yeah,
unnecessary.
Right? Yeah. I mean, and the UK agreed to stand by us, but France and Germany were like, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And while there had been almost unanimous support for the war in Afghanistan, there was a lot of criticism, rightly so, for the war in Iraq. And this is when we start to kind of see the anti-war movement start to ramp up in the United States.
Yeah.
And people like Bill Clinton and the Pope were both saying, hey, military action is not a good idea in Iraq. But still, in July of 2002, we were like, you know what? We're going to go ahead and enter anyway. And listen, nobody is arguing that Saddam Hussein is like a nice guy. Like, we know that he's like a piece of shit dictator.
A big ass piece of shit. Like, no. He's not a great person. But I feel like it was super opportunistic to be like, oh, another Middle Eastern country that we want to, you know, invade. And because it's the war on terror, everybody in America, like civilians, are going to be fine with it, because if we tell them that there is a threat, they're going to be fine with it. So it really is so clear, especially now seeing the weird message that that guy sent to his people about finding a connection to Saddam Hussein. It really goes to show you how there really was no like factual basis in that war.
And Bush and Donald Rumsfeld both admitted later on that there were no weapons of mass destruction. Like, they were like, oh yeah, whoopsie, there was nothing there. I mean, and that is kind of how it was framed. Like, you
just wanted Saddam Hussein.
You watch these, they wanted to protect our interests. Like, that's what it, I mean, and that, but
yeah,
that's really what it was. It had nothing to do with protecting the people of Iraq. And that's kind of what they started to say, was that like, hey, we did this because we were trying to protect the people of Iraq from Saddam Hussein. And it's like, no, you weren't. That's not why you went in. We know that's not why you went in.
But it was optically put that way. I mean, do you remember the day that his statue went down?
Right. The PR machine worked overtime to make us all feel like proud patriotic Americans. Again.
Of course. Like, we took him down. We saved the Iraqi civilians and all this stuff.
Right. So, but I mean, when you watch videos of Bush talk about this moment, about like, hey, would you have done anything differently if you had known that there weren't any weapons of mass destruction? He's kind of like, difficult to say. Mistakes were made, basically. But his whoopsie cost more than 4,400 U.S. service members' lives and approximately 200,000 Iraqi citizens who died in that war.
And I think this is finally when people outside of the liberal hippie Haggerty family started to see that the war on Iraq was actually an issue and not something that we should just be okay with going along with.
Yes, absolutely. Like, that's the war, the anti-war movement really started to speed up at this time.
Yeah, when like normal people were starting to realize that like this was a really big problem. I always think about the John Mayer song, Waiting on the World to Change. And it was just kind of when it became more part of like popular culture to be against the war, where before, I think if you were outwardly against the war, it was something that was like seen as being unpatriotic or un-American, where suddenly we were seeing more people showing their patriotism as being anti-war.
Right. And it also had a really adverse effect both domestically and overseas, because it reinforced, like you were saying, it reinforced this idea that bin Laden had been saying all along, which was that the U.S. was going to go into Muslim countries and dominate them and get people killed.
Yes.
Which is what happened.
We fucking did.
And then there were the pictures from Abu Ghraib. So we already talked about Guantanamo. Abu Ghraib prison, which was a prison that we had put up in Iraq.
Yeah.
It is, if you haven't seen these images, I would not Google them, because it is some of the most upsetting. It is United States service members posing with tortured bodies, humiliating imprisoned Iraqis. It's gross. It's very upsetting. And so the American people are starting to get, it's already an unpopular war. We already don't know why we're there. People are dying. And these are the images that we're getting. And then additionally, because we had two wars going on at once, which was very confusing.
Yeah.
We weren't able to focus on Afghanistan. So we went in, we overturned the Taliban. There was relative peace in the country from like 2002, 2003. Mm-hmm. But then we shifted our focus to Afghanistan or shifted our focus to Iraq, which left the Afghanistan people high and dry and allowed the Taliban to start reclaiming areas, which was horrible.
Why did we fuck up so badly?
I don't know, but we really, really did.
It
and
makes
things,
me really like, well, shouldn't we have smarter people in charge?
Well, I guess not, because when looking at the cost of this too, you know, there was someone breaking down on that documentary, kind of the cost of everything and how much money was wasted.
Oh.
Millions, billions of dollars.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about the cost, because this is fucking ridiculous. So according to the Cost of War Project at Brown University, the war on terror will have cost $8 trillion for operations between 2001 and 2022, plus $2.2 trillion future costs for veterans care over the next 30 years. In direct spending, the U.S. State Department of Defense reports spending $1,547 trillion from 2001 to February of 2020.
Right. And
trillion.
And
trillion.
When you hear them talk about trillion. What the money was spent on, Madigan, it's so, when you know that this country has a real lack of funding
for the shit that fucking matters,
for education and healthcare and underprivileged communities and a massive unhoused population,
yet our military industrial complex is sitting fucking mwah, pretty
on stuff that had to be thrown away. Like they talk about it, and they bought planes that didn't work
and
had to immediately be scrapped.
And yet our veterans are not properly cared for.
They're not
for
cared
either.
For.
Like, that's the thing that blows my mind, is the amount of money that we have put into something that was so senseless, so fucking stupid, that really did absolutely nothing, that killed so many Americans, that have put so many other Americans into complete distress. I mean, the number of soldiers that came back with PTSD is astronomical.
I'll say this, before we recorded this episode, I watched an episode of that documentary series Turning Point on Netflix, and I come from a military family.
Yeah.
Again, my dad, my cousins, they've all been deployed multiple times, multiple deployments.
Yeah.
Watching soldiers talk about their experiences and what it was like to watch just one, watch half of their battalion die.
Yeah.
Because they stepped on a bomb.
Yep.
Or something like that. And two, watch the idea, because we were so brainwashed in this country about what we were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So watching them kind of grapple with the fact that they went there because they were idealistic and they thought maybe they were doing a good thing. They were defending their company, kind of.
They were defending
their country, and they were rescuing these people.
Yeah.
And that's what they thought they were going to do.
And
not everybody,
when they,
but a good portion
and
of them.
And then when they realized what was actually happening, I mean, I mentioned the guy that I dated when I was younger who was part of the military. And he had told me during that time that there had not been 1 year since he'd been back in the United States that he hadn't had one or more friends of his commit suicide.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
As a result of their PTSD from the war.
Yeah.
And it is such, and that's the thing that I think that when we go into war, we don't think about what it's actually doing to our citizens as well. And when we're going into a war, I mean, I think it was very similar to Vietnam, where these people are like, no, we don't want to be fighting this. We don't understand it. And there's so much trauma involved. And yet we're throwing all this money at this problem, yet we're not actually able to help the people that were defending our country. And that's what's so upsetting. Even if they have spent $2.2 trillion or however amount of money they've spent on these veterans, it's still not enough to care for them after what they've been through. And that's fucked up.
Well, and it's still not. And like, I come back to this same thing, and this is where I end up when we talk about, this is the longest running war in United States history. And we talk about, was it worth it?
Yeah.
And it wasn't worth it for anybody. Like, that's the thing. It wasn't worth it for anyone. It wasn't worth it for the people of Afghanistan or the people of Iraq or our people. It wasn't worth it for anybody.
Yeah.
And when you hear people talk about it now,
20 years of hell.
Right. And you hear Michael Flynn talk about this, or you hear like a lot of the generals who were in charge in varying stages throughout this process. They all say, we were kind of winging it. We had no plan. We had no exit strategy. We put ourselves and our nation and other nations through this massive trauma where tons of people died for what?
Yeah.
For
especially
nothing.
Now. So let's talk a little bit about what's happening now, even though I'm sure a lot of our listeners also listen to our news episodes. It's things that we've been talking about a lot lately. But when at the end of the Trump administration, the beginning of the Biden administration, they were discussing bringing our troops back from the countries they were in and back to the United States, ending the war, all this kind of stuff. And there was this push to bring everybody back. I think originally it was like August 30th that they want to bring everyone back. And then Biden had this whole announcement that by September 11th of 2021, the 20-year anniversary, everyone will have been, you know, evacuated from these countries and things like that. And we've seen the disastrous outcome of pulling away too soon or incorrectly or whatever, you know, you see it as. And that's what's frustrating to me, because I've been wanting this war to end for so long. And I think there's this idea of once we get the troops out of there, it's over, it's done with, we don't have to think about it anymore, except for the fact that in this day and age, everything is so heavily documented by everybody's cell phones, and we are able to see the complete devastation that is happening in Afghanistan, in its capital of Kabul, at the airport. We've seen some really, really disturbing images that really are quite parallel to 9/11. I mean, I think of the people hanging onto the airplane the same way as I think of the people who jumped out of the Twin Towers. Mm-hmm. And to see it end in a way that had such destruction, it ended the same way it began. There was no point of this that was peaceful. There's no part of this that was handled with care and correctly, because I feel like, honestly, right now our administration was so obsessed with bringing everybody home and being able to say that they did that, that they weren't thinking about the fact that the Taliban was gaining more control. And that they're back in power.
And that they so have really, been steadily for a long time.
Because it's like what you said, when we went to Iraq, we started leaving the door open for things to happen in Afghanistan, where I wonder if we had really just focused on one thing. And I don't believe that war is the right way to accomplish what we wanted to do. Because if you wanted peace, war is not how you create peace in other countries. So to me, it's frustrating that it's like, oh no, we're going to go in there, we're going to help them, we're going to rebuild their government, we're going to do all these things.
But it's a fallacy to think that that's ever what we really wanted. I think that's the problem.
It's completely not what we wanted, but it's what they wanted to say. But they can't even say that, because now with no thought to what is happening in their home country, we are pulling the rug out from underneath everybody.
Well, we've always done that. Good at that. Like, listen, the United States government doesn't care about you.
No,
like, that's kind of...
But that was the whole fucking... That's
but
what
they lied.
Been telling.
But they
I
lied.
Know, and that's what's so fucking frustrating to me.
But they lied. Like, I think clinging to this notion of, like, but they said this thing. It's like, but they lied.
Like, I know, but come on. Like, the thing that pisses me off the most is that once Biden saw the shit that was going down, could they have said, okay, maybe we're not going to hold on to this symbolic goal to have everybody out by September 11th.
But the problem
is... Do you not fucking care about anybody besides
I think the problem is with Biden, with all of them, I think the problem is you have decades of no plan. Like, I don't know who's going to be able to do this right at this point.
I mean,
because
yeah.
how do you...
But
how
maybe
do you
stop
after
pulling people once you realize that the Taliban is taking over?
But what's going to be the right way, Madigan? Like, the way that it's done now, I'm like, I don't know what the right way is now.
I mean, honestly, like, you got yourself into this mess. You fucking finish it. Like, if you started a war against the Taliban and you now see it, they're taking over, like, maybe fucking do something about that now.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Because
if
I'm just
war
like,
was the answer in 2001, why is war not the answer now? And I'm not saying war is the answer at all, but when you've started something, you better fucking finish it.
But there was no plan to finish it, and there hasn't been
exactly
a plan to finish it for 20 years.
That's what makes no fucking sense. They're like, we're just gonna pull the troops, and now the people of Afghanistan are fucking fucked
again.
And that's what's so frustrating again to me, because nothing was accomplished.
And it was interesting
absolutely
to see
nothing.
And you know, this was a Mujahideen leader, so
yeah.
I mean, a a militant extremist leader, so take what he says with a grain of salt, but I do think that this was true. He said, what's the difference between the occupation of the Soviets and what's happening with the United States in my country right now?
Yep.
You don't want to call it an occupation, but what's the difference? You called us freedom fighters back then, and you call us terrorists now.
Yep.
Because we're against you.
Yep.
But you're destroying our infrastructure, because that's what's happening now.
Yeah.
Because what's happening is the people of Afghanistan are being stuck in the crossfire between the Taliban and United States
yep.
soldiers, where we're just blowing shit up like left and right. It's not just the Taliban. It's us, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I don't know. Like, at this point, and that's what makes me want to cry. And that's
well,
what makes me so frustrated, because I don't know that there is an answer.
There isn't, because we fucked up 20 years ago. That's the thing. And that's what makes me so
And we fucked up before that.
Mad.
Yeah.
It's like if we had responded to these attacks in another way, and I'm not saying that I know what the other way would be. I'm not saying that I have the right answers. That's not my expertise.
I am saying maybe don't go off of pure emotion.
Yes.
Like,
well, that's the thing, is that I feel like, but because that was what the country was asking for at this time, was retaliation for these attacks. And that gave anyone in politics the okay to do whatever they wanted to do. And that was my issue as a 9-year-old. And that's my issue now as a 29-year-old, was the reason that war doesn't solve anything. It's the same reason why we say an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. If somebody attacks you, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to come back and do the same thing. And I'm not saying I have the right answer to how we should have responded to this. That is not in my wheelhouse. I don't have knowledge in that exactly, but I wish there was a way that we could have responded to the 9/11 attacks that wouldn't have destroyed millions, if maybe billions of lives within the past 20 years.
Well, and if you factor in, and I know that this is on a smaller scale, but if you factor in the reverberations that it has caused across families, we talked in our mini episode, I read a 9/11 story, and we talked about the way that it changed the way we consumed news, which changed the way that we identified as Americans,
yeah,
and led us to this point
and
caused
us
these divides and these rifts in families. My dad is broken.
Yeah.
From, and it's a direct, you can draw a direct line.
Yeah.
Like between 9/11 to his deployments, his several deployments,
but that's
to who
thing,
he is right now.
As you can see, like, that makes sense to me.
Right.
When you say that you come from a military family and your father was in the military, and we now, you know, you've discussed a lot on the show about your father's views and, you know, your relationship with him at the time right now. And I think that
And he's physically really broken too, because by the way, the government does not take care of its veterans physically or mentally.
That's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. It's just, it makes sense. As heartbreaking as it is, and for people who have loved ones who have gone through this and you want them to see the light, it's so incredibly frustrating, but we brought this upon ourselves.
And how do you convince people that their trauma and this thing that they've devoted their life to for all this time means nothing?
You can't. They have, and that's the thing that's the most frustrating whenever you're dealing with anybody who is struggling with mental health issues or addiction or brainwashing or whatever you want to call it. There is no way to bring somebody to the light. It has to be on their own. And I think that's the thing that is so polarizing for people who have watched their loved ones go down this path of self-destruction, really. That's so frustrating because you can only lead them to the water. You can't make them drink. You know, you have to wait for them to be able to see the light for themselves. And as somebody who has gone through trauma and so many other things and probably a lot of mental gymnastics too, to convince themselves that what they're doing is good and right and defending their country, I can understand why people would become broken. And that's what's so upsetting to me as well, is that I don't know how to repair that. You know,
I don't know if we can repair it. And no. I think that that's the thing that, like, this doing prep for this episode made me very emotional, because there are no winners here.
No,
like, everybody lost. Everybody's losing. And I don't know how we get out of it.
Yeah.
I even right now, I don't know how we get out of it.
Well, I think what we did is we just ended it and we're walking away and we're wiping our hands clean of it. I think that's the way that it's ending. And it's unfortunate, because I hope that there are charitable organizations who are working their asses off to be able to help these people and support them in some way. But honestly, at this point, I think that what our government is doing is wiping their hands clean of this whole problem and walking away. Before we end this episode, I want to remember the lives that were lost during this war. Between 363,939 and 887,072 civilians were killed post 9/11 in Afghanistan.
Which is a huge gap. Like, we're like, we don't know, somewhere in this range.
I mean, it's like an over $200,000 people range. Yeah. But many more also died due to related effects of war, such as water loss and disease. Total Americans killed during the war on terror, including military and civilians, is 10,008, with 7,008 of them being killed U.S. troops. The United States Department of Veterans Affairs had diagnosed 200,000 American veterans with PTSD since 2001.
Yeah, so I know that we said we were going to close with this. We've already answered this question. Was it worth it?
No.
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 It wasn't worth it from a monetary perspective. It wasn't worth it. We didn't do good. Not lasting good anyway. There may have been moments of relative peace that we were able to give the Afghanistan people after we've already disrupted their homeland.
Yeah.
But...
And what is this going to do for our future when we've spent 20 years in these countries causing terror
and their future
and havoc
and their future
havoc? Yeah,
like, I don't know,
because that's the thing, is that these radicalized groups have their reasons for being upset with Americans, and that was why 9/11 happened to begin with. And now we have a whole other generation of people who know nothing other than war and the U.S. troops being part of their lives. And so I can understand how that would radicalize more and more people.
Yes.
Are we creating more and more opportunity for other terrorist attacks
hands
to happen?
Hands down, yes.
Yes.
Yes. They talked about it in the documentary that I watched. But yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Because
we made them more mad.
And yeah, by the end, it's not like a lot of people in Afghanistan were super stoked that there were American troops there. And because of that, and because of things like Abu Ghraib and that happened at the time, it radicalized a lot of people. It pushed more people into the Taliban.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And can you blame them? Honestly, like, yes, there is a lack of understanding on how someone can be radicalized. But at the same time, if you are raised with certain beliefs, just like United, just like us in the US, you know, the people who've gone to QAnon and anti and whatever, sure. You know, it's like
radicalization is not rational.
Right. But there's a reason still.
Sure. Yeah. There's always a catalyst. Right.
Like,
yeah.
It doesn't mean that it's like a rational reason, but there's a reason for it. And I feel like we've mm-hmm. almost been like giving people reasons to fucking hate us and to want to retaliate against us again. And the Taliban is just as powerful now as it was 20 years mm-hmm. ago. So yes. What are we going to do about that? Fucking nothing.
Nothing. Well, this is the most depressed I think I've ever been at the end of an episode we've done. Sorry.
It was meaningless. It was so fucking meaningless. And 9-year-old Madigan is telling fucking everyone I told you so.
I don't know. It's a very complicated issue. It's not complicated. It's very straightforward. But
it's complicated. It's emotionally in the complicated emotions.
Because it's all so painful. Well, like, that's what it is.
Think about our two episodes that we just did.
Exactly.
Like, the first episode was very much about our trauma, our experiences, our emotions. The second episode has been so much about what we've inflicted upon other people. And that's why it's so
painful.
And that's why it's so complicated.
Right.
Because it's not just about us and our experiences. It's about people that we've never met across the world that we know are in torment and, because yeah. of us.
So here's the takeaway, I guess, if we have to try and leave this on any kind of positive adjacent
or any sort
note,
of moral note,
is that loss of life, especially on this kind of massive scale, is painful.
Yeah.
It's traumatic, whether that's here with the bombing of the World Trade Centers, or it's overseas with hundreds of thousands of civilians and service members, probably just teenage boys and girls
yeah.
who went in right after high school with an idealistic view that they were doing something good.
Yeah.
Regardless of who it is, it's not fucking worth it. It's no. never fucking worth it.
And you're affecting more than the person who dies. You're affecting the people who loved them and cared for them. And we are potentially radicalizing more and more people. And I think that's blood on our fucking hands at that point. If there is another terrorist attack from that area or anything, like, that is our fucking fault.
Well, and how many domestic terrorists did we create because of the environment that we created here in,
exactly.
in the United States?
Exactly.
Because of the situations yeah. that we found ourselves in. Like, it's just, there cannot be a war on terror because you cannot fight an idea.
Nope.
All you're doing is giving it attention, which is watering it and watching it grow. Like, yep. that's it. So yep. that's kind of my final takeaway, is just the war on terror doesn't even make sense.
It doesn't make sense. None of it ever made sense. I really hope that, you know, because I know that we have mostly listeners that are younger than us, I am hoping that our discussions of the timeline and the different things that happened are helpful to those who maybe weren't alive or aware of everything that was going on, or to people who weren't reading the news at that time and things like that. I hope that, if anything, our discussions in this episode can help the next generation possibly make better decisions. And I'm not saying we have that power as a podcast to be able to change the next generation, but I'm hoping the more that this war is discussed and we are able to dissect its problems, and people smarter than me can think of better solutions, that's the only positive that we can possibly get from the numerous mistakes that mm-hmm. we've made, is that hopefully we would have learned something from this experience so that generations to come can make better choices.
Yeah. I mean, it would be really nice if we could just stop killing each other. It would be great.
War makes no sense to me.
It's never going to happen. We've been at war since the beginning of time. We'll be at war till the end of time. But it would it would be really chill if
everyone
we could just
leave
stop.
Everyone alone.
Yeah, if we could just cut it out, that'd
leave
be great.
Alone.
Yeah.
Okay. Keep to yourself. Keep to yourself. Oh my gosh. Well, this was a very emotional couple weeks for us. Yes. It was definitely very heavy. Both of us felt a lot of things. We encouraged you last week to reach out to us with your 9/11 stories. I would also encourage you to reach out with us with just any thoughts and feelings that you had on this episode. It's not healthy to keep it bottled in. One of my very favorite things about this show is the communication that we have with all of you. So if these two episodes have evoked any sort of feelings or emotions or memories or anything in you, and you feel like you want to share it with us and with the rest of the listeners, please email us at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com or direct message us at angryneighborhoodfeminist. We truly do learn so much from all of you who write into us. And I do feel that our listeners also, you know, reap so many benefits from hearing your stories besides just the two of ours. We have a Facebook. Oh, yes.
Real quickly, before you go into the final spiel, I do want to say that we are coming up quick on my wedding and your girl is overwhelmed.
Yes. I'm
hanging on by a thread here.
Yes.
And because of that, we have made the decision. Madigan has so graciously allowed me to make the decision to not put out full length episodes until after the wedding,
because we care more about Keegan than we do about content, right? Everybody, we love her.
I am dangerously close to a panic attack. Yes. So we are
well, that's the thing. We would never encourage any of you to go beyond what your psyche and your abilities are at the moment. So I wouldn't want to ask anything else of my co-host.
Thank you.
If she needs to take a break, take as long a break as you need to.
I didn't want to do it, but I just feel like I think I will lose my mind if I don't. So
right. And we don't want that.
We also want
your wedding to be a very, very happy day.
Thank you. And we are going to continue to put out What's in the News episodes every week. So you will get those, of course.
Yes.
But I did want to let you know in case you're like, hey, what's going on?
Yeah.
That's what's going on.
Yeah, it'll just be a couple weeks. The countdown is...
We'll be back.
We're going on. She gets married October 2nd. So we'll be back after that. But yes, thank you for reminding me and reminding the listeners that that is happening. Everybody send positive vibes to Keegan.
Thanks.
We love her. We only want good things for her in the world. All right. So back to my spiel. If you're on Facebook, go to our business page and rate and review us. You can go to the group page and chat with the other listeners. I love all the things that you guys share. I love all the things that you all share. Keep it coming. I adore it. I am still keeping close tabs on those reviews on Apple Podcasts. I see how many of you listen. I've seen how many reviews there are. So if you're looking for a reason to leave us a positive review, this is it. If you haven't done so, please go to your Apple Podcast app and leave us a 5-star review and a quick sentence about why you love us. It is the best way that you can possibly support Keegan and I, and it truly means so much to us to also see your lovely positive words about our show. All right, with all that being said, we encourage you
to rage on.
Bye.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.